You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Rashad Tabakawala. Rashad is the chief growth officer at Publicis Group, an advertising and communications firm whose 80,000 employees worldwide are dedicated to delivering marketing and business transformation. He is responsible for supporting the leaders of Publicis Group's largest global clients to help these organizations grow in a revolutionary time for all businesses. For his pioneering innovation, Business Week named him one of the top business leaders, and he was dubbed one of five marketing innovators by Time magazine. He regularly presents keynotes at industry conferences and speaks at well-known global organizations such as Kellogg, IBM, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. He has a new book. It's called Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data. Rashad, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We interviewed the behavioral scientist Dolly Chugg for the podcast, and she suggested that people should think of inclusion and equity like they think about their iPhones, that we're always looking to upgrade. So think about like tech. In this book, you're making an argument that as the world becomes increasingly data-driven, it becomes even more vital that we focus on what makes us more human, right?
Absolutely. So the underlying concept of the book is that every business, every individual grapples with the spreadsheet and the story. Mm-hmm. And today, because of our data-driven, computer tech-based age, we may be tilting too much towards the spreadsheet and forgetting the story. And so I build a case as to both from a human as well as a business perspective why combining spreadsheet and story and not forgetting the story is critical.
You cite a statistic in the book that 90% of the data in the world today has been created in the last 2 years, and our current output of data is roughly 2.4 quintillion bytes a day. That is astounding numbers.
They are astounding numbers, and because we are flooded with so much data, it brings to mind a poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Mm-hmm. He had a line in the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, which went something like this: water, water everywhere, and all the boards that shrink. Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Mm-hmm. Today we live in an age where there is data everywhere. So much data we will sink. Data everywhere. Pray who will help me think.
So what happens when you are deluged by data is, you know, you lose focus, communication becomes more difficult, and even relationships get weakened, right? Because we're not meeting each other person to person.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons why people are now utilizing data as a key interface is data is not only a global language, but data is easy to deal with, but human beings are not easy to deal with.
Right.
The case I make is if you don't have human beings and you only have data, we have two big issues. Outside of the fact that it's most uninteresting, there are two big issues. The first one is what exactly do you do as a human being if it's only a data-driven conversation, because computers can talk to each other and don't need us.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And then the second issue, which is as important, is no brand, no human being, or nothing has ever differentiated itself just on math alone. You know, it's like basically saying we're an electricity company. I don't think there's a single company in America that differentiates itself on the way it uses electricity.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But because we are today in this data-driven age, everybody basically says they're a data-driven tech company. And outside of a few, yes, there are a handful, like a Facebook, a Google, and Amazon. Almost nobody else really differentiates itself on data. But we have now become besotted by saying we're a data-driven company, and it will sound as funny as we're an electricity company in the future.
We recently had an academic on the show who was sort of predicting the downfall of Facebook in 8 years, kind of looking out on that. That's her work. And Amazon, which is this behemoth, I couldn't believe this line from your book, that they recently sought a patent on a digital wristband which was designed to monitor employees' productivity. That's insane.
Well, yes, and what is tended to happen is because things are measurable doesn't necessarily mean they need to be measured. But what happens is when you have one of those wristbands, there are two issues, really. The first is just that it feels very dehumanizing.
Yeah.
It feels that's just one more step before they replace your carbon-based wrist with a silicon-based technology, mm-hmm. and you're done with. But the other is, it feels worse than 1984. It's basically you're monitored all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I basically call out, is most people don't realize that there's now ways to monitor. In fact, when people come in and out, you know when you have those turnstiles at the bottom of the building where you have to swap in and out? All of that is being monitored. So for instance, you know, in my company, we figured out that somebody would come in, swipe in, and then turn around and swipe out, and they said they were at work, right?
Yeah.
And my whole stuff is, as soon as you basically do anything digital, it's being monitored.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the key issues is, if you're always being looked at, are you really a human being, or are you basically an image trying to be a human being?
Yeah, I think we know the answer to that. So let's talk a little bit about the importance of the in-person, and specifically as it relates to meaning. Because you write in the book, quote, "In the quest to find the balance between the story and the spreadsheet, meaning is what matters." And I want to pair that with a quote you have from Joan Didion, who said, quote, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live." We do want to think that we matter and things mean things and there's purpose at our work. And that's often not the case.
Yes. So what we've discovered, meaning both at work as well as a lot of what I've read,
mm-hmm.
is that there are two reasons why people work. One set, which is important, is some combination of fame, money, and power.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's human, which is you want to have to make money, you'd like to be known that you're really good, and there's some power. But while that is necessary, it's never been sufficient. If you look at organizations which have high retention of people, if you look at organizations which are successful, people also look for three other things. One is personal growth,
mm-hmm.
which is a form of meaning. The second is the purpose of their company and whether they align with the purpose of the company. And third is the connections they feel with their fellow employees, bosses, and clients. And those are completely human, if you think about it, which is purpose, connections, and the idea of growth. And industry after industry, when you look at companies that give the people that, including, you know, some idea of freedom, and companies that don't, you see some amazing, astonishing results. And I point out the difference between United and Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And Southwest, in every financial term, does better than United, but they treat their employees really well.
Mm-hmm.
Because Herb Kelleher basically said, if you look after your employees, they will look after your customers. And it's a very obvious thing. You see the same thing. Until 2 years ago, there was a huge difference between Walmart and Costco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you walked into a Walmart, you were kind of not very happy. You walked into a Costco, you were,
mm-hmm.
because the Costco people were treated better. And so when people say this is soft stuff, I say, no, this is soft stuff that delivers hard results.
100%. So you and I share a love of the Chicago Cubs. There's a great example you have in the book, because I think you, especially in professional sports, you assume that players are going to go where they can get the most money. But that's not always the case.
That is not the case. And so this was basically when, you know, they had their title run 3 years ago leading up to it, as they were basically attracting some of the best talent. And the talent had to basically recognize that there were three issues. One, the Cubs had never won. Mm-hmm. Second is Chicago has these balmy winters, right?
Yes.
And the third is there are people who are willing to pay more money. Mm-hmm. So what the Cubs did is anytime someone would come in, they understood the key points that made their life important. So they would, for instance, the example I give is someone comes around and they realize that the person is, his wife is, I mean, they're expecting a child. So they talk a lot about preschools and a lot about the other things, because they basically realize that they're not actually just hiring the baseball player, they're bringing into their family his family.
Mm. Did you ever hear, this was from, one of our podcast guests told us a story about Joe Maddon, that if you violated team rules, what you had to do was go up to Maddon's office and pick a piece of paper out of a bowl. On that piece of paper was an expensive wine. You had to go buy a bottle of that wine, come back, and you drink the wine with him as you discussed what happened.
I haven't read that, but that is actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, there's an angle or an aspect to that, which is how do you basically build a culture where people can speak up and you can speak with them? Because the sole idea of in-person meetings, and I have a chapter in the book, which is have more meetings, because a lot of people say eliminate meetings. And I build a case that you should actually have more in-person meetings.
Yeah. And when I saw that title, I screamed no, just to be honest with you, because I could but the kind of meetings you're talking about are ones that can be stand up check-in meetings. They can be and if you structure these things well, so these meetings have a purpose and everyone knows what they are and they don't just drone on. Another thing that you and I share is I do a lot of public speaking. You do as well. I don't use any slides. And you say you don't either.
Right. I don't either. And so what has tended to happen when it comes down to meetings, the reason we don't like meetings is because, A, we have meetings where there are many more people than they need to be because technology allows people to dial in.
Yeah.
We have meetings where we basically have a lot of process but little purpose. And then we have meetings where we spend a lot of time and no one gives it attention because everyone's looking at a screen or is asleep at home and pretending to dial in, et cetera.
Right.
All right? And so we basically have all these meetings, which are really people gather around sort of a display looking at numbers, which is meaningless. And that's why those are meetings I say that we try to avoid. But if you actually think about your career and how you've grown, you've actually grown through interactions of small meetings. So I basically suggest meetings where you do not have technology in between, mm-hmm. Or minimum amount of technology. And I sort of ask that there are conversations. And someone basically asks a question and someone answers. And ideally, try not to pull too many sheets of papers and slides and just have a conversation. And so I define five types of meetings that are extremely important. And those have meetings like a meeting which is a woodshed meeting, sort of like the Joe Maddon meeting, which mm-hmm. is you have to basically tell someone they haven't done right. Then you have the Jerry Maguire meeting, but without the Jerry Maguire histrionics, where you can go to a boss and say there's something wrong.
Yeah.
But as importantly, it's the unknown meetings. I've learned so much when people have said, hey, can I just meet with you? And I did not know who they were. And I learned a lot because of their questions and they exposed me to new worlds. Mm-hmm. Or you basically have can I help you meetings. One of the most amazingly stupid things that I've heard is don't go to meetings unless you can get something out of it.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why people find meetings miserable. I say don't go to a meeting unless you can actually help somebody.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Because at the minimum, you're helping something else a meaningful meeting. And my favorite meeting is let's just go have a beer, because that's mm-hmm. how you build relationships. Or, you know, if you don't like beer, have some coffee or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I also love that you have a chapter essentially talking about the need for businesses to bring art into their world. And this is something we talk about all the time at Second City. And you have a lovely quote in the book. You say, great art helps us see differently. So unpack for us why you think art is so important in business.
The reason over the years I've understood that art is so important is for a fact, a multiple number of reasons. The first one is this. Most companies truly do believe that innovation is extremely important to their future success, mm-hmm. right? And they're trying to be more entrepreneurial and be more innovative. I define innovation as fresh, insightful connections. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you've got to see lots of different things. And if you sort of think about the great artists, they basically connect different dots, which is number one. Mm-hmm. But I also believe that artists are the ultimate entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So whether you basically are a stand-up comic, or you basically are a writer, mm-hmm. or a painter, or a sculptor, or a performance artist, you start with a blank sheet of paper, an empty rule, a block of wood, mm-hmm. and you create things. So to me, the ultimate entrepreneurs are artists. And because of that, there are four things that they do which are amazingly important. The first is they allow you to see things differently. You reframe things, just like a comic makes you think differently. Yeah. So they reframe. The second is they take risks. But you take risks. Mm-hmm. The third is you learn how to basically come back from defeat, because that is usually what artists basically end up doing.
Yep.
And the fourth is you basically imagine things that have never been imagined. And so my basic belief is a lot of marketers, business people, people go off on offsites. And to me, the ultimate offsite is to actually encourage everybody in your company to basically go and see the arts. You know, go to Second City, go mm-hmm. to the Art Institute of Chicago, go read a book, come back and talk about it. Fund that, because in effect, people get to see things differently. But the single most important reason, besides the reasons of it's innovative, it's entrepreneurial, it allows you to see things differently, is that I truly believe the way you communicate at work is through stories.
Yeah.
And I basically use art to communicate. So in the book, I talk about how I try to convince people who think everyone is following them, instead of telling them, look, you're barking out orders and you have this title, but you haven't actually won anybody's hearts and minds. If I tell them that, you know, they'll say, like, who are you? So instead, I show them a scene from 400 Blows where this coach runs out blowing a whistle, and you have this overhead shot of all these young boys following him, and then they peel off. He's running around blowing the whistle, and they're running off to a movie theater or to go get something to eat. Mm-hmm. And I say, this is what basically happens. And it's an amazing way of communicating. And so my basic belief is art allows you to communicate and tell stories, and that's the way you actually manage people.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even like television shows like The Office were wonderful ways of pointing out the everyday dysfunction that happens at work. In comedy, again, being a way to sort of slay elephants in the room, but protect everyone is an important part of communication. And we work a lot with the behavioral science community, and they talk about the ways in which we will go to great lengths to tell ourselves stories that are not true, just to justify the sort of bad behavior that we're exhibiting. And this is really toxic when it comes to bosses.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, and later on in the book, I also talk about how to deal with these toxic bosses.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because it's hard, right? I mean, people don't leave jobs or companies. They usually leave bad bosses.
Yes, they usually basically leave bad bosses, and people basically leave bad bosses, and they leave bad cultures, which are obviously indicated by bad bosses. Mm-hmm. But I give bad bosses and good bosses hope, because what I basically say is, look, every person is a human being and has in them the characteristics of a good or bad boss. What makes a good boss is they usually do the good stuff, and when they do the bad stuff, they apologize or they realize they've done it. Because under a pressure situation, you can sometimes be a bad boss. Mm-hmm. And the good bosses tend to have these five characteristics. One is they're capable. They actually know what the hell they're doing. Mm-hmm. But as importantly, they have integrity. They have humor. They can inspire people, and they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But bad bosses have the following characteristics. And some of us on a bad day have some of these. That's what I try to remind people. One is the narcissist. And the narcissist is basically, you know, it's like it's I, me, mine. So they basically believe they're actually on the second city stage at work every moment. Everyone's got to look at them.
Right.
Right. The second one is the micromanaging fiddler, which they have to touch and do everything in a project without which nothing happens. Mm-hmm. The third is what I call the Oscar contender, someone who slams doors, sighs, you know, yells, screams, keeps quiet, whatever.
Yep.
And the last one is the double-crossing assassin, someone who will tell you something. And all of us recognize these people, and some of us on a bad day may have some of these characteristics. But what I basically say is we have to speak out and bring out those characteristics. And the way you can also do that is by showing them, you know, stuff from the office, stuff from other stuff, versus indicating them sort of directly. But what I do say is if you cannot try to change a bad boss, you should leave the bad boss, and if necessary, you should leave the company. Mm-hmm. Because what I've discovered is if a boss is bad, the culture turns really bad, the company turns toxic, and then it hurts you.
Yeah.
So while it took a lot of years, anybody who works at, you know, Harvey Weinstein's company doesn't want to claim they work at Harvey Weinstein's company, or people who worked at Enron.
Yeah.
So my whole basic belief is sometimes you have to just leave these toxic environments because it's actually the smart thing to do, though in the near term it's hard because you're giving up a job.
You talk about a good boss that you had and a story where you had to take a late night train to Urbana, Illinois.
Right.
Yeah, yes. Tell us about that.
So one of the key things, and one of the chapters I have in the book is about the importance of what I call tattoo moments, that many times in our career, we look back at these moments that made us, and usually, hopefully, they're good ones, but sometimes they're not good ones. And in this particular case, there was a massive new business pitch. And because of a variety of reasons, I had to go to Urbana-Champaign to catch a plane from there. Mm-hmm. And it was late in the night, and I was asked, basically, by my assistant to catch this train and end up, you know, on this in this little town. And this was before there was Uber, before there was any of this stuff, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm sitting out there thinking, it's like, it's midnight. How do I get to this station? I mean, how do I get from the station to the hotel? Mm-hmm. Because there's no cabs. I haven't rented a car. I wonder what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's midnight and the train is 2 hours late. And standing there, it's almost like a scene from Casablanca, this fog-filled station mm-hmm. under a light. Probably not in a trench coat, was my boss, who was the number two person in the company managing 50,000 people, staying there for 2 hours saying, hey, I realized you needed someone to drive you, so I waited here to drive you.
Mm,
right?
That's amazing.
And to me, that was like, hey, this guy actually cares. And so those things actually matter because, you know, we eventually choose with our hearts and we use numbers to justify what we just did.
Yeah. This comes up a lot in the book, and it's something that we talk about all the time at Second City, which is, you know, you would never go to a sporting event and think that the teams didn't, you know, warm up and that sort of thing. And you go to concerts and you know that they rehearse and rehearse and rehearse. But there's so little practice in business on a daily level in the very things that make the difference between success or failure. We don't practice our communication. We don't practice our collaboration. And I think we're missing that. This is not something that just like happens to you overnight that you have a talent. It's a muscle you have to flex.
It's a muscle that you absolutely have to flex. And what tends to happen is you will find that over time, the successful people in most organizations, it's been true historically, but it's going to be much more true even now as we move into the future, are people who basically know how to communicate, inspire people.
Yeah.
Right? And relate with people. And unfortunately, doing so and building those skills or teaching those skills is a messy practice.
Right.
It's like learning stand-up,
mm-hmm.
right? You just don't have sort of, you know, you're not immaculately delivered as a stand-up.
Nope.
Right? And so to a great extent, our inability to do that becomes sort of an issue. And today, because of modern technology, which I am very positive towards, mm-hmm. I often find that people in the same room would prefer texting each other than looking and talking to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Practicing eye contact, practicing listening to the end of sentences, all the nuanced ways in which we are actually communicating, which is why, you know, you can't name me a person who's closed $1 million deal by email.
No. And what tends to basically happen is nobody has tended to close it like that. And as importantly, if you haven't built the relationship when things get tough, you have nothing to lean back on. You just got rows and rows of data and charts and emails, and the whole thing falls apart. And you know, we build business, and human beings have to realize that not only are we messy, but the most successful people tend to just make fewer mistakes.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that we don't make mistakes, but we don't want to even make mistakes today. And so we basically try to be this. We try to Instagram our business life, which is pretty horrific.
Yeah. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story from your life. But before we do that, chapter 4 of your book is titled Talk About the Turd on the Table. I can only imagine the editor at some point was like, really? Do you really want to title a chapter this? But I'm going to let you talk about what you mean with regard to that title.
Sure. So the idea basically is that we have to talk the truth to power. And often we sit around in a conference room and there is this brown, wet thing in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
And many of us discuss it like it's a piece of brownie,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, hey, look, we got a piece of shit here, which is, you know, the turd on the table.
Right.
And it's sort of, it's a more, I would say, different way of saying elephant in the room.
Yep.
All right. But it's like the turd on the table. But hey, can we now talk about the turd on the table, the unspoken, the obvious, right? And I basically have now proven beyond doubt, and not that I haven't proven, I've got research that has proven beyond doubt, that if you have an organization where people can speak up and say there's something wrong, right? And sometimes they may be wrong about something being wrong, but unless they speak up, it's very, very hard for two things to happen. It's very hard for creativity to flourish because, in effect, you're not allowed to speak up and take risks. But as importantly, it's very hard to spot a problem and take care of it before it ingests the entire company. Most recently, we had some, for the last 2-3 years, we've seen what's happened to Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
With Wells Fargo, it was like, just open accounts. And people basically didn't speak up. And now it's a company who has had its third CEO in 4 years. Its stock price continues to languish and not do as well as the other banks. And more recently, unfortunately, for a company headquartered in our town, Boeing, mm-hmm. it's become so clear that culturally, the issues of the 737 MAX were obvious 2-3 years in before, but people didn't feel free to speak up or management refused to listen, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, now it has basically truly hurt an amazing company. And so the culture of an organization is extremely critical.
Yeah, truth tellers aren't very popular inside big sort of spreadsheet companies.
That is absolutely true.
All right. So we end the podcast every week by asking our guest for a yes and story, a time in their life when they normally would have said no. And they didn't just stop at yes. They said yes and. They affirm and contributed in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story from your life or business life.
Yes, I do, and many of them. And, you know, a few years ago, and now I've been known to do this, I had a very talented individual in my company who basically wanted to start a gaming company. Mm-hmm. This is about 10, 15 years ago, you know, when online gaming and gamings were getting hot.
Yep.
And I basically said, okay, if you really want to do that, yes, you can leave what you're doing, and I'm sad to lose you. But the and was, I'm going to build a company here for you. So why don't you launch our gaming company versus going around and doing a gaming company by yourself? And so I got to keep him in the company half the time while he did the gaming company. And that signaled to a lot of my talent that I actually cared about new things and cared about talent.
That's a great story. The book is called Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data. Rashad Tabakwala, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me very much.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fain. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.